I think all of you probably would be a little surprised at what I consider the real theme of that challenge to be. It's a theme that certainly is espoused by this season in which this meeting is being held. Because by any standards of major faith, this is a holy season. It's a time that people are looking to the God of their creation, the God of their understanding, for divine guidance and hope. It's a time when they look for the rainbows, when they dare to believe in miracles, when they dare to think that even the least of these is important in the eyes of that divine creator. It's a time to reassess, to reevaluate, and to learn once more the lesson of what really brought us all together here in the first place. It's a very simple message that brought us together that started thousands of years ago. Culminated in the seed being planted that began a major assault on this area of disease in the human family, the disease of addictions. A message that mankind has basically never understood, most of the time misinterpreted, always tried to rewrite the script, and somehow always managed to believe that they knew how to do it better than God himself did. And that message that came to us really was that we love one another enough to lay down our life that another person might live. As I look back on the history of the movement that brought us all together, even before Bill Wilson finally felt a spark of fire ignite in his heart in a hospital bed, but a people seeking and searching for answers to the hopelessness that had plagued the human family for thousands of years. They had gone under many labels. First written of in the Holy Scriptures and the incidents of Noah and his drunkenness following the first harvest, following the great deluge, and lying naked on his blanket, exposed to his family. Written about much of the time in the Holy Scripture by God and various prophets of God interpreting the meaning of life. Just about always encompassing the story of total and complete forgiveness. Which is still one of the greatest healing components involved in recovery from these diseases. A forgiveness by the God of our understanding, and second unto that, a forgiveness of ourself. And a realization then that our life really had purpose and meaning and direction. And having those things, it was given that great ingredient of hope, which then inspired us to reach out and to touch and to embrace and to care and to sacrifice. As I think back on many of the biblical stories that I could probably paraphrase, might frighten some, but to me, these people of the scripture obviously had alcoholic and addictive personalities. One of the most obvious is the prodigal son. Must have been a great con artist to talk his old man out of one third of everything he had when he really didn't have it coming, and to get it in cash. And then the way he spent it even did me justice in the best of my days. And where he wound up, I wound up in the pig pen, in the crap, eating husks with the hogs. Meditation at that point comes easily. I had great empathy for him then, thinking that even the lowest of the servants in my father's house were better off than I was. Because this is the story of God and man, isn't it? The story of a realization that when even the thought crosses our mind and our heart, that we should turn back to our Creator, He has already forgiven us. Notice he didn't even have to climb out of the pig pen. He didn't even have to set foot on the road. But his father saw afar off that his mind had changed. And he immediately prepared a great welcome home. What a message of love. What a story of hope. And I could go on and on, but I won't. I can think of many others in the biblical phase that obviously exemplify the personality of the addicted, even if they didn't use the substance. Jonah is one that I think of frequently. There's nothing that indicates scripturally that Jonah was a tippler to a great, great extent. But he certainly had the personality. When God spoke to him, he took off. He took all sorts of evasive action to avoid that voice of God that was following him and speaking to him. He went just as far as I went to evade the message God was trying to get to him. He left his family. He ran down to a foreign place. He took the geographic change. He even took a sea ship to a foreign country, he thought. He got caught up in a maelstrom of a storm that pitched and tossed everything there was, and he hid where? In the bowels of all of creation, hiding from God. And everyone in the ship wailed and cried out at what was wrong, and they didn't know, and finally someone asked him, and he told the truth. And he said, throw everything overboard, and they did, but that didn't do it. And finally he said, throw me overboard. I saw myself in that, with a gun in my hand, attempting to throw myself overboard and evade and run from God. But in Noah's case, God had a great fish, the scripture says, waiting, with mouth open to receive that which the people gave. With great relief, they got rid of him. They vomited him up into the belly of the fish. And there he stayed for a few days of meditation. Just as I spent a few days in the many jails in deep meditation, waiting to be spewed out somewhere on the shore. that fish spewed him out on the shore in the midst of its vomit. And Noah shook himself off and said, maybe I should listen to God. And that's about the way we react at that point. Maybe this God of creation really means what he seems to be saying to us. Well, out of the depths of hell we were born. Out of the condemnation of the earth, the abandoned, the forgotten, the beaten, the frozen to death, the unwanted, unwashed peoples of time, God visited in these last days with a messenger and said, even you, find wholeness, forgiveness, healing, and love, and restoration. Oh, there are lots of great diseases. They attack all parts of the life support systems of the body. Some of them even cause us to lose hope. A few cause us to curse God, perhaps, with pain and suffering and affliction. But seldom have we ever seen one that attacked every life support system of the body, physiologically destroyed every part of the human existence, affecting first the brain, the control system, causing us to do and commit insane acts, even to endure periods of temporary amnesia. For some of us, that amnesia became permanent. And while doing these things scarred our soul to where the pain and the warping and the killing of our emotions was such that our spirit died. And we ran from God and we hid in the bowels of the earth and we cursed God and denied his existence. And then in the final hour of our despair, having no place else to turn, we surrendered and said, God, I am powerless over this thing that controls me. We found in that total surrender victory. Because a messenger had come our way, and God picks the most unlikely of messengers. Even though they don't want to listen, they can't escape the assignment. Because he won't leave us alone. That messenger came about the time I took my first drink in life. Bill Wilson was getting that message in a hospital in Manhattan. And though we were on dual tracks, there was no way I could escape from that message from that time on. It was going to catch me no matter where I ran in the earth to hide. It would eventually reach me. And it did. From New York to Akron to Chicago to Omaha to Des Moines to Sioux City to Storm Lake and finally to Ida Grove, Iowa, right out there in the northwest frigid part of the universe tonight. And tapped me on the shoulder and, of course, like all people, for in the final stages of this disease, I denied like hell that I had it. There was absolutely nothing wrong with me. And I would have fought the world to prove it. But persistence ultimately paid off. Because you see, what was born was birthed with the pain and suffering and the affliction of thousands of years. And it was a message. It was not given to the scientist, the physician at first, the theologian, but to the afflicted. And we carried it because we had found that the crux of the message was this, that unless you give it away, you can't keep it. That unless I love someone else enough to share my affliction with them, there was no way myself that I could survive. So one by one by one by one, through the years, the message came, and it began to grow because the seed was planted and the garden was watered with the tears of a million suffering mothers and children and the afflicted of the centuries that cried out for hope and justice. And there had been born in this creation a movement that will never stop, that will never cease, until it has touched eventually every person in creation to give them an opportunity to understand that there is a way to get well. When that movement started, no one knew what was happening, and it has continued and grown. When I got up from the floor that night, 34 years ago, next February, and stood naked before God, alone, filled with despair, abandoned, I cried out, "God, help me. I can't help myself." It was a prayer. It was a confession. I said, "God, give me direction. Show me the way. Help me today. And if I live, as long as I live, I will share this moment in every place you give me an opportunity to share it." I've tried to keep faith with that commitment because I will always believe that God touched me that night in desperation. And let me choose between life and death. And showed me that by choosing life, I had to give of myself to others, or I would die. And as I followed that pathway in the course of the next years, for me there was only one hope of living, and that was to come closer to that God, whatever that meant. I found out that many men and women had pioneered that course and that roadway. I found out that for no two of us was it exactly alike, but that in every instance there was a power greater than ourselves, outside of ourselves, that was motivating us and moving us. I found out that the pathway they had pioneered had milestones and guideposts and directions given, and that there were conclusions drawn that if you followed this pathway and you followed this roadmap and you went this direction, there would certain results happen. And eventually, in a convention not unlike this, though money smaller, these men and women sat down together and discussed how they had managed day by day to stay well. And by staying well, I mean stay abstinent, how they had managed to enjoy living and enjoy life. And they found there were certain common things among them that had happened, or they wouldn't have been there. And these they set out as steps along a roadway of recovery. And their conclusion at the end of those steps was that if you have taken them, you will have had a spiritual awakening. Which obviously to me believes that if we thoroughly have taken that roadway, then some sort of increased awareness of man's inner spirit and spirituality and relationship with the God of his understanding will have taken place. And with that, they will have the commitment to live one day at a time by certain precepts and principles which they have come to believe in as a way of life. And that leads to another conclusion, that they will then carry that message and give it to others where and when it is essential. And in chapter 5 of the book that resulted from that, we all know how it begins, because it says in a promise that I know of no other major disease in the world able to give those who are critically ill unto the death with it. It says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. In other words, if you thoroughly follow the way and the directions and the understanding, you've got a better chance of recovery than any other killing disease in the world today. Yet we are the only disease concept in which, if the person has a relapse, they want to shoot you instead of rapidly admit you for more care. Or build a new prison to put you in rather than put you in a fine recovery center. Our sense of understanding at this point is still primitive, isn't it? My state's debating whether they should build a new prison in which to warehouse those who have third-time convictions for driving while intoxicated. They don't say much about what to do with them the first time, and we know at least 75% of those need treatment. And the second time, probably 100%. And the third time, who's to ask the question? And we all know, male and female, that for those who are arrested, if you're a woman, you got 1,000 times better chance of not being filed against than a man. We also know that in every county of the country, they have different methods of prosecution. I can take you to certain counties in Iowa where they haven't prosecuted anyone for 5 years. That sure as hell doesn't mean no one's been driving on those roads drunk the last 5 years. It just means they're not going to prosecute them. But in the next county, they might. So the standards are different, aren't they? Where are we? What is the challenge to America today? We're growing. We have made a lot of progress. I won't recite all of the history. I wanted to share with you a part of my own progress and growth. Back in the early 1950s, I prayed and hoped for the day when I could someday see sitting in a room a gathering like this, discussing intelligently with professional people the problems and understanding and relationships of addictive diseases. You see, I didn't know alcoholism was a disease back in the 40s. Not many people did. I thought that the way I had been raised and been taught, that I was in rebellion against authority and rebellion against God and just plainly the black sheep of the human race. And that everything I did was a willful act to destroy myself and my relationship with God and my family. I had no way of knowing that I was one of 4 generations of alcoholics. I had no way of knowing that the first drink I ever took probably had already sealed my fate. I had no way of knowing that when I took it and that first surge hit my brain, that I was in the grips of something I would chase to the gates of hell and the doors of death, defy all authority and nations, kings, and God himself before I finally surrendered and said, I can't go any further. I didn't know that it would descend through my children and my grandchildren of whom have been through treatment this year. When people call me up today when they read about one of my grandchildren being in treatment because of who I am and say, "My, we're sorry about your poor grandson." I said, "This is the first time I've been proud about him for 10 years. I've loved him, but I haven't liked him for a long time." And before it was over, he looked me in the eye and told me he loved me. And when he went in there, he was going kicking and screaming and hating my guts. Because it's a painful way to get there and recover. We go through these myths of alcoholism and treatment. What's the percentage? What good does it do to commit someone? They won't get well. What kind of malarkey is that? We all know better than that now, don't we? We all know also that if you're going to wait for every person in the world to reach their bottom before we do anything about their drinking, that there are going to be more bottoms in America than anything else. We can do something about the problem in America. We don't have to wait till we're dead the way we used to. Yes, perhaps I was a part of a pioneering group of men and women in my own way. A challenge that I carried that carried me to run for office because the primary motivation I had was to do something about this disease in an official and a public way that could lend it enough credibility and acceptance that someday we wouldn't be treated like the scum of the earth, that we wouldn't be hiding under logs, that we wouldn't be running secretly down alleys to attend a meeting to try and stay well. Someday, pray God, that maybe some medical university will really treat this subject like it ought to be treated. We're trying. In 1964, when Look magazine did a story of my life about the governor of Iowa who had been an alcoholic, and that story hit the newsstands 30 days before my election to my second term as governor, and I went home and told Mrs. Hughes to pack her bags. I said, "We're going to be moving in January, I want to tell you." A little doubt about what the public's going to think of this. And 3 days before the election, when my attorney general stood in a statewide public television debate on television and said, "Folks, I hate to tell you, but the governor's been lying to you. He was in jail in Kissimmee, Florida. And he hasn't admitted it." And he went on and on how I must have wiped the records clean in the state and got rid of all the driving records against me and everything else. When I was introduced and got to the podium, I said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I want to tell you one thing. Everything the Attorney General said about you is true except the fact that I lied. I just never told you about it at all." Now, if he'd look far enough, he'd find out I'd been in jail in 5 other states, too. But that isn't what I came here for. I am an alcoholic. I haven't had a drink in X number of years. I regret the pain, the suffering, and the affliction that it caused and brought to the people that I love the most. But this election is on the issues that we face as a people together. And as far as I know, the question of my personal health has never been brought up before. But since it has been, I want to tell you that I consider myself to be well. Because I abstain from alcoholic beverages. Completely and totally. I was elected with the greatest plurality ever given a politician in the history of my state, before or since. And my attorney general went down to defeat, saying a man should have as much credit for never having been an alcoholic as he got for being one. And I said, "I have to agree with you, Mr. Attorney General. I never brought the subject up. You did." Then I remember the first letter I got following that story in Look magazine came from the secretary of an AA group in the state of Florida. my staff laid it on my desk, and I thought, boy, here's a real gem, you know, probably a good one from someone that loves me, laying there on my desk when I walked in the morning. I opened it up and looked at it and said, "Dear Governor, I hope you're drunk by now, you son of a bitch." And I looked down, it was signed by the secretary of the group. And at first anger hit me, and I thought, well, of course, he went ahead with his great indignation how I'd violated the tenets of the institution of AA and all those things that I know we're not supposed to violate and always have known, and that I hadn't violated because I hadn't willfully discussed anything about Alcoholics Anonymous with anyone. I still haven't, if you follow my words carefully. But anyway, in response to him, I wrote back, and I don't recall the name of the particular gentleman. He's perhaps long gone now, but I said, "My dear brother, you obviously have reached a state of serenity that I've never been able to achieve. Would you please share with me?" A lot of other problems in the world that people in my constituency thought were ultimately more important than what I seem to be devoting a lot of my time to. Because you see, I've always been told there's no votes in trying to care for the drunk, the addict, the imprisoned, or those that are condemned to death. The poor, the helpless, the abandoned, the hopeless, and the least of these in our midst. And yet, if there's any message that I have ever been able to discern coming clearly through the scriptures in all of my life, it has been that message. When did I see you, Lord? When you visited me in prison. When did I feed you, Lord? When you gave to one of these who were hungry. When did I heal your wounds, Lord? When you bathed the wounds of one who was sick and couldn't help themselves. It's the eternal message of love. It's hard to love the unlovable. St. Francis was one of all. I one time looked throughout history and said, I would like to find those great human souls in history that somehow made a difference because of what they believed and dared to believe in the way they lived. St. Francis was one of those. And there is a story, myth or reality, I don't know, told of St. Francis that meant a lot to me, and I'll share it with you. Because St. Francis, a person of total sacrifice, gave up everything that he had in life, even threw his clothes down in the dirt of his city, stood stark naked, and walked away, saying he would have nothing of his own. At least he held on to that more than he held on to Christ. Insane, yes. In the eyes of almost anyone, that's insanity. Never would he stay in one place more than 3 weeks because he didn't want to become attached to that place so much that he dared to call it his own or think of it as home, because he felt that he had no home. A man who developed the stigmata, the wounds in his body that Christ bore on the cross, and who concealed them so that they might not be seen. A man who died early in life, blind, and at his moment of death, asked his brothers to lay him in the dirt because he was worthless, and that he might die in a totally baseless condition, unworthy of God. And this story is told that while sleeping one night in a cave, he had a vision. And in this vision, he met the Lord face to face, and the Lord spoke to him and said, "Francis, when you get up in the morning on your road to Rome, you will meet a leper face to face. And I want you to embrace this leper and kiss him full on the face. And Francis awoke screaming and said, "Lord, I cannot. I am afraid more of anything in the world of leprosy than any other thing." And his brothers said to him, "What awakens you, Francis?" And he shared with him the story of the vision that he had of Christ, telling him that when he left that morning on the road to Rome, he would meet a leper face to face. And their advice to him was, "You know what? Francis, don't take the road to Rome this morning. Go the other direction." Sounds like advice we would give, doesn't it? Francis, he knew better. He replied immediately, "It doesn't matter which road I take this morning, I will meet the leper." And when he left, in the mist and the darkness of early morning, he heard the tinkling of the bells which were required of lepers to wear to avoid people to stay away. And he kept moving. The closer he got, the leper started shouting, "Unclean, unclean!" But Francis kept walking. And the leper begged him, "Don't come closer," but he walked on. And he walked up and he looked the leper full in the face as he hid his eyes. And he reached out and he embraced and he kissed the leper, with the leper weeping and begging him to leave him. And he stood cold and filled with fear and deathly afraid and turned to walk away. And his brothers shouted, "Look back, look back." And you know what he saw? The leper was totally healed, made whole, cleansed from head to foot, standing firm in the flesh and clear of eye, praising Almighty God that he had met a saint face to face. And the healing power of God had touched him and made him whole. The healing power of God has touched us and made us whole in much the same way. But we live in a world of men, so we require the laws to be changed that imprison us and condemn us. The setting up of the bill and the passage of what has become known as the Hughes Bill in 1970 created a new break in American history and perhaps in world history, not because I was the primary author, joined by other many men in the Senate, and passed unanimously by the Congress and signed into law by President Nixon on the last day of the year. But it was a change. And it began a new movement. And when I then made a decision 3 years later to leave the Senate and not seek re-election, there was wailings and moanings the length and breadth of the land among people who knew me that the movement would die. And I said, it can't die, because it's been in the hands of God from the moment it was born till right now, and it will not die because the movement came from God, not from me. I am but a small nodule, an instrument in the pathway of all there is. And paralleling these tracks, there has come a voluntary movement that has risen to one of the greatest voluntary movements in the history of the world, that has covered every nation on earth, every sitter on earth, and touches the lives of millions and men and women tonight as we sit here listening and talking. It has been paralleled by professional development, to where 50 years ago there were no treatment centers, only insane asylums, only condemnation and death, to where right now, as we sit here tonight, there are more than 8,000 treatment centers in the United States of America alone, and more developing every week that go on and on and on. We have national laws, we have third-party insurance coverage, we have tens of thousands of trained counselors. We have professionals and doctors and psychiatrists and psychologists. 40 years ago, you couldn't find one. It was like looking for a needle in a haystack. The movement has been exploding. We fight with each other. We growl at each other. We even hate one another once in a while. There are money grabbers in the business who think more of bodies and beds and money than they do of treatment and help and health. But there are also saints on the roadway to Rome, meeting every day in those beds with loving hands and healing kisses, and God in their heart. So don't always look for the devils, look for the saints. You never see the rainbow looking in the mud. You have to lift up your eyes unto the hills and realize that God brought something into being. That if it had been born of man, most certainly it would have failed, but since it was not born of man, it cannot be defeated. You and I will have to do what we have to do. We can't roll over and play dead. There are battles to be fought. There are wars to be won. There are victories to be acclaimed and challenges to be made. There isn't a dozen medical schools in the U.S. of A. tonight that have an adequate and sufficient curriculum on these subject matters anywhere. School counselors are not being trained. Teachers are not being trained. The textbooks are not written. The challenge is, will we do it? My belief is, yes, we will do it. We can't be turned back. We will hit political administrations who will cut our budgets, cut away the programs, tear away everything that we do, but they cannot kill us. Ever can they kill us. We are a movement, not just a political movement, a movement that is inspired, that found itself in the soul fire of pain, suffering, affliction, tears, and finally, love. Don't be afraid to wage the political wars that are essential for us to wage. We have a constituency numbering in the tens of millions in this country. If there are, as the statistics indicate, the numbers of us that we indicate in this country, then we are the single largest political force existing in America today if we unite. And I want to tell you, there isn't a president, a congressman, a senator, or an ambassador, or anyone else in creation that will turn away from that political force if we are one mind, one spirit, and one heart about what should be done. But if you want them to give it to us in dollars and cents and do it for us without labor, sweat, and tears, then we are wrong, we don't merit it, and we don't deserve it. We got this way because we loved one another and we cared enough to get out and sweat and do something about it. We'll continue because of the same sort of commitment. There's nothing wrong with government programs that fill the vacuum of need to take care of the poor, the indigent, the ethnic groups, the abandoned, the forgotten. Governments will always have to do that as a part of the corporate soul. Private enterprise in a free country must take up the cudgel of the other. Fight for the laws and the essential to provide treatment for those who can afford it and should afford it and be able to pay for it. We need to move along both tracks. One is not the enemy of the other. The one supports the other, and they should support each other. We need understanding. We need commitment. We need education. I thank God for conferences such as CCAD. I thank God for men such as Conway Hunter, who had a division. He had a vision given, in my opinion, by God. And he dared to follow that vision, just as men and women have followed other visions. And tonight we celebrate 10 years because a dream became reality. And it enabled me to see a lot of old friends I might never have seen any other way. And to assure all those old friends that this is really my hair. I haven't gone bald and bought a wig. Every 10 years I change my hairstyle just as an act of love for me. And to confuse everyone out there who is trying to say that I no longer exist. I feel better, think younger, have as much zest for life, more love and will to do something that I've ever had in my life. And the reason, primarily, is because of you. Let's make a recommitment of our lives. There's a real need in America, and more than that, a much greater need in the world. Not a time to fight each other. It's a season of reconciliation. It's a season of love right now. This is a meeting that has grown because people loved one another enough to sacrifice their lives that one another could be brought to good health and live. If there was ever anything born of love, it is this movement. And committed and extended by love to each person that it's touched. I'm proud that I'm an alcoholic. I thank God that He allowed me that rare privilege of being born into human history at this time with a disease that would be coming into an understanding, and to give me the rare privilege, a farm kid from the Maple River Valley, with little understanding and little education, abused and battered and stormed by the world, not understanding what was happening to him, could in a moment of desperation be touched by that mystical power. I'd given the strength to go forth into a state, a nation, and a world, and give testimony to kings and presidents and parliaments and governments of the earth that we are people who can, who will, and who must be treated with respect and dignity and given our share and our place in the family of man. We ask for no more. We will accept no less. Because God has given us that privilege and that right. Thank you very much for inviting me.